That's Isaiah 53, beginning at verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many. And he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sins of many and makes intercession for the transgressors.
Our second reading is Matthew 20, 17 to 34. And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside, and on the way he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day." Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something, and he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." And as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him. And behold, there were two blind men sitting at the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. But they cried out the more, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." And stopping, Jesus called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they recovered their sight and followed him.
What do you want? Dream dreams. What do you wish for? If you could ask for one thing, what would it be? Let's sharpen the question up a little bit. In particular, what is it that you want Jesus to do for you? Well, in today's passage, there are two pairs of people, both of whom find themselves in the presence of the most powerful king ever to walk this earth. And what's more, he asks both of them, "What do you want?" So what will they ask for? What would you ask for, given the opportunity? Well, it turns out that what you ask for depends on your eyesight, on what you see That is, it depends on what you see when you look at Jesus. So remember last week, if you were here with us, we considered Peter's statement to Jesus back in chapter 19, verse 27, where if you look, he said, "See, we have left everything and followed. What then will we have?" So notice the first word there, "see." Peter was drawing Jesus' attention, well, to them, to the disciples, and what they had done. Peter at that point thought that was what determined what they would get. And then we heard Jesus' parable in response. Do you remember? And it ended with that question in verse 16, "Do you begrudge my generosity?" Or as Jesus literally put it, according to the footnote, "Is your eye bad?" That is, to experience God's generosity, but then to focus on ourselves and how others compare with me, is to have this problem with our eyesight. And then today's passage begins at verse 17. "And as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside, and on the way he said to them, 'See, look, pay attention.'" And in particular, Jesus is about to describe, once more in Matthew's gospel, what's in store for him. Jesus is trying to get the disciples' attention off themselves, and yes, to look to him. Because the question is, as they look at Jesus, what do they see? And this really matters, not only because, of course, we want to see Jesus clearly, but it'll determine what we see in Jesus will shape what we ask from him. Because it'll follow what we think we need from him, what we think he can give to us. What do we see in Jesus? So that's our question. What do you see in Jesus? And first of all, we see here the one delivered over. The one delivered over. Verse 18, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem. And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And he will be raised on the third day." Well, notice that repetition in both verse 18 and 19. Jesus is going to be delivered over. First of all, he's going to be handed over to the Jewish religious leaders. We don't find out here who's going to do that handing over, although Matthew has told us earlier, and it's all going to start very close to home for Jesus. But then in the hands of those religious leaders, they will give their verdict: death. Then as a result, Jesus again will be delivered over, handed over, this time to the Gentiles. They will say cruel things about Jesus and mock him. They will do cruel things to Jesus and flog him. Then they will crucify him. Crucifixion, this agonizing, public, humiliating death inflicted on the dregs of society. And that is what Jesus wanted his disciples to see. Notice too who is doing this to Jesus. So we do have the Jews represented by the chief priests and the scribes, but then the Gentiles, the non-Jews, the nations as well. But you see the picture, it's the whole world will be ranged against Jesus. The world hates Jesus. But do the disciples see this? Now what we've picked out so far is not the whole story when it comes to Jesus, but what more there is to say, which we will come to, doesn't in any way cancel out what we've just seen. Jesus wants his disciples and us with them to see. He'll be delivered over, condemned, mocked, flogged, and crucified. So do the disciples see this? And we can get the answer to that question by looking at what they ask for. What do they want? Well, that brings us to verse 20. "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something." Now, earlier in Matthew's gospel, James and John were called by Jesus from their father Zebedee's fishing boat, and now it's mum coming up to Jesus with her boys alongside her. And notice we're told there that she asks Jesus for something. The way that is phrased is obviously highlighting and focusing the obvious question is, well, what? What's this something that she and her boys want? And so Jesus asks, verse 21, what do you want? She said to him, say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom. In Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, Malvolio says these words, be not afraid of greatness. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Well, James and John want to achieve greatness. And the way they see to do that is to get ahead, to have a better place than others. After all, if you think of a throne, well, there's only two sides to a throne. And so they want to nail down those spots because then others can't have them. And so here they are making their bid. But as we read this in the flow of the passage, it really is, isn't it, so jarring. What are they thinking? Jesus has just told them that he's going to get seriously pushed around by others, to which they respond by seeing it as their cue to push themselves forward. And yet, of course, it may not be that shocking when we realize the same has happened down the centuries ever since. That is, there are people who do know something of Jesus, even that he died, and yet they still really think in terms of Jesus, how can he help me get on in life, push forward? That being on Jesus' team really is all about making life for me better in this world compared to others. Now, there are different forms of blindness. Some, if you like, supposedly look at Jesus, but all they see is the weakness, the suffering, the unpopularity, the one who doesn't get ahead at all, and so they simply turn away and go in the other direction. They can't see any reason to follow a loser like Jesus, because that's simply not the kind of life they want. So they don't ask anything for Jesus, except maybe for him to leave them alone. Now, they are blind to anything that might be on offer than that anymore. But that form of blindness is not the disciples' problem, because rather they are onto something, because they have realized that Jesus is the King, even the Son of Man, God's great King. And on this journey to Jerusalem, it seems they are swept up with the crowd's expectations. Something very special is going to happen when they get to Jerusalem, even that this is going to be Jesus' ascent to the throne. Because after all, remember what Jesus himself had told them back in chapter 19, verse 28. In the new world, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And so with all that heady mix, James and John see their chance. Surely now is the moment to ensure they get those key cabinet positions in the kingdom. And yet Jesus has just said verses 18 and 19. And yet they've completely missed it. They haven't seen it. You could say they've got good peripheral vision. What I mean is that in verses 18 and 19, they latched onto what came up the first edge, Jerusalem, Son of Man. And maybe they just caught what came at the end, being raised to life at the end of verse 19. But all the stuff in the center, well, they missed it. Their central vision was lacking. If they'd seen anything of what Jesus had said was going to happen in Jerusalem in those middle verses, surely they wouldn't have made that request now from Jesus. In fact, Jesus tells us, as he goes on to say in verse 22, you do not know what you are asking. Haven't they been listening repeatedly in Matthew's gospel over the last few chapters? Jesus explained he is going to be treated like dirt. He'll just get shoved around the place and then he'll be disposed of in the lowliest way imaginable. And not only had Jesus said that, he had also made plain what awaited those who would follow him. That his life would be a template for his disciples' lives. that they too would face hardship and worse, that the world would oppose them just like they do Jesus, that any who would follow must deny self, take up cross, and follow, lose their life now. And so having said Jesus that they don't know what they're talking about, he goes on with the follow-up, verse 22. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? That is, do the disciples think they could suffer like Jesus was going to suffer? Of course, it's obvious, isn't it? If they had any insight, any self-awareness at this point, they would at the very least hesitate to answer that question. But not James and John, because they're blind to what's awaiting Jesus, to what it means to follow. We are able, they say. But then there is this twist, isn't there? The disciples are obviously getting this wrong. Jesus essentially says as much. But then comes the surprise of what Jesus says in verse 23. He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." So remember again, this cup speaks of the suffering that Jesus is going to endure. And Jesus says, yes, James and John will share in that suffering. Although Jesus says what position that would lead to was not up for him to say. But obviously we are wondering as we read this, do the disciples really understand? Have they got it yet, what Jesus is talking about? The kind of suffering he's been preparing them for. Turns out this is not the last time this notion of being on Jesus' right hand and his left appear in Matthew's gospel. A few chapters later, we read this. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. So do the disciples really want to be close to Jesus the King? Do we want to be close to Jesus the King? Well, here's what it means. It does mean take up the cross like Jesus. Deny self like Jesus. To lose your life for Jesus and the gospel. Which, take a step out for a moment, in due course, as Jesus here predicts, is what James and John will do. In Acts, we discover that James was killed with the sword for his stand for Christ, and then his brother John was persecuted, even imprisoned, even into old age. Which just shows us following Christ really is costly. In this world that opposes him, those who wish to follow will suffer. Back into Matthew 20, at this point, we the reader are now alerted that others are also listening in on this conversation. Verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. Well, no wonder those disciples are indignant. How dare James and John do that? Which, of course, is what any disciples would have done, given the chance. James and John had just got in there first. They'd stolen a march on the rest, and the rest are livid. So now that all the disciples really have been gathered into this situation, Jesus now spells out for them the ordering of relationships in his kingdom. He wants to tell them, this is how it's going to work for my people. Verse 25, but Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. So now we get the idea of the great ones. And of course, that's been on the agenda all along, really, for the disciples. Jesus gives two examples there from the Gentile world of lording it over others and exercising authority over them. But notice the repetition in both cases. Greatness is measured in terms of being over others. And of course, that's what we've been seeing, isn't it, in this last chapter or so in Matthew's gospel. It was that desire for more than others that drove the grumbling in the parable last week. And then James and John. This greatness for them is determined by comparative position to others. And of course, that's the way of our world. I was reading in the paper yesterday of the current jockeying for position in Boris's cabinet. It made for a great read. I've no idea if it was true or not, of course. But it was very believable because that's what the world is like. office politics, family infighting, playground squabbling. I was also struck, even more, isn't it? The more money you give to charity, the higher your name goes on the board, on the wall. It's everywhere. The ambition to be over others is just the way the world works. But the kingdom is different. In contrast, Jesus' followers will stand out from the world, as he explains from verse 26. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave. So here's the mark of a follower of Jesus, a servant of the kingdom. He or she is a servant. And that means, quite simply, the aim is no longer to get ahead of others, but to serve them. And again, service, unlike our world, is not done with the aim of getting credit for it, the humble service in the limelight, not at all. We will serve simply to meet the needs of others, to use whatever it is that God has given to me, not by puffing myself up, boosting my credentials before those around me, but simply for the good of others. Is that how we see things? Because it's not yet how the disciples see things. Because they're still looking, they're still seeing things, even what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, in the world's ways. They are blind to these ways of the kingdom because, of course, they are blind to the king. Ultimately, they don't see Jesus as they should. And so now we're going to look again at Jesus. We've already heard that he's the one who is going to be delivered over, but we also need to see that he is the one who gives his life, the one who gives his life. So we're on this journey to Jerusalem. What's going to happen when we get there? From what Jesus has said so far, it could be heard that that is where he will lose control of his mission, of his destiny. That is where he will become this passive political pawn as he is handed over repeatedly, even to be condemned, mocked, flogged, and crucified. Now, much of that, in a very real sense, is right. It is true. Jesus really was treated like that, like a nobody. And yet we are to see at the same time, without cancelling that out, that of course there is much more. Of course, Jesus never lost control. It's been obvious all along. He's been determined to get to Jerusalem. And once he gets there, he is still very much the one driving the agenda all along. Verse 28. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. People speak of losing one's life. People think Jesus lost his life when he got to Jerusalem. Well, Jesus would have us be clear. His life was not taken away from him, as if for God's king. Rather, Jesus actively gave his life. What does that mean, that he didn't lose it, but gave it? Well, the key word we're told here is ransom. Ransom, that's the language of the marketplace, or even in particular, the slavery marketplace. And as we say that, immediately the whole Bible storyline, doesn't it, comes into view, brings to mind the Exodus, when God rescued and redeemed his people from that slavery in Egypt. Which means that in Matthew's gospel, this one verse, chapter 20, verse 28, has far more significance than we might even at first realize. Matthew wants us to see that here is the key for how Jesus is bringing about an Exodus-like rescue. Now, there are pointers to this right from the beginning. Do you remember when the infant Jesus had to be rescued from the clutches of the Herod-like Pharaoh who would kill the youngsters? But then, if you like, it really kicked in. It was drawn to our attention. Well, in the middle few chapters in Matthew 14, 15, 16, where described for us with Jesus feeding miracles, providing bread for thousands, just like God did in the wilderness after drawing his people out of Egypt. And then we had to puzzle through, why did Matthew record two such miracles for us, feeding the 5,000 and then the 4,000? And you realize, well, the first was in Jewish territory, then the second in Gentile, as if to say this Exodus-like rescue which Jesus is coming to bring is not just for Israel, this is for all the world. But still, what does this mean, an Exodus-like rescue? You might look back to the first Exodus and think, but they were slaves in Egypt. But in the first century, the people of Israel weren't back in Egypt, and certainly the whole world wasn't in Egypt. So what kind of Exodus-like rescue was this? Well, we could ask, in particular, what was the slavery from which the people needed to be rescued? Well, look back and remember those two feeding miracles, and in between, well, Jesus explained, he said this, out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. First on that list, evil thoughts. And the evil thoughts in our hearts are supremely evil thoughts about God, that we have turned away from our Creator. We did not consider him worthy of our attention, to love him with all our heart and mind and soul. And in this attitude towards God, we became slaves. There was nothing we could do to escape it, to change our hearts. And there's nothing we could do to escape either the judgment which such hearts deserve. But Jesus, the Son of Man, God's glorious King, came to give his life as a ransom for many. That is, Jesus gave his life at the cross to set us free from this slavery forever. It was the only way that slaves like this, like us, could be set free from God's judgment and instead to enjoy blessing and rest and heavenly treasure. So in Jerusalem, we are seeing one who is acting for the sake of others, to meet their needs, to serve them. Jesus gave his life to give us life. Here we see true greatness. But do we see this, really? Well, what do you want from Jesus? Jesus continues on his journey here to Jerusalem. He passes through Jericho, getting close. And there we meet another pair of individuals, two blind men at the roadside, presumably beggars. And they too have a request for Jesus. They cry out, verse 30, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. Now, crying out for mercy is a regular occurrence in Matthew's gospel. There's another pair of blind men who did just that back in chapter 9, as did a Canaanite woman in chapter 15. You might remember that woman's cry annoyed the disciples. They wanted to get rid of her, but she persevered. And now likewise, the crowd don't want to hear these blind beggars either. They tell them to shut up. But the blind men are having none of it. They cry out all the more, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David, mercy. That's what they want. Because as we look at Jesus, as we see his determination to head to Jerusalem, and then what he endured there, well, if we've seen that, what is it we think we really need from Jesus? Is it really that we need a little help, a little leg up, to be a little bit more impressive in the world's eyes? Is that really what we need from Jesus? Well, at this point, that's still where James and John are at. Or have we realized this far greater need, which is the only way to explain Jesus' actions? Because after all, if there's anything we could do to help ourselves, well, Jesus needn't have faced the horrors of Jerusalem. but he had to go there. And he did, because the state of our hearts was too desperate. Sin is slavery. There is no escape. The only rescue was for Jesus to suffer and die. And if we see that, then we'll get it. What I need urgently, desperately, is mercy from Jesus. And Jesus really is the one to go to for this. Twice the blind men address Jesus as Lord, and then twice they call on him as the Son of David. Son of David, that's a title for the king in David's line that God had promised throughout the Old Testament, this glorious Son of Man person. And yet Jesus doesn't go to Jerusalem to suffer despite being God's king, as if all of this and the crucifixion was an unfortunate aberration. Not at all. Though Jesus goes to Jerusalem to suffer and die precisely because he is God's king. He had come to serve his people, to do for them what they simply could not do for themselves. As the scriptures had foretold, and we heard it earlier, he came to bear the sin of many. And so, like those blind men, we can cry out to Jesus with confidence. Not with confidence in ourselves, that would be ridiculous. We deserve nothing from Jesus. But we can have confidence in Jesus. Because at the cross, we look and see Jesus really is determined to serve the needs of others, even enslaved sinners. He even gave his life. And so if we see that, we will come to him and ask for that mercy. If you've never done that, today is the day to do it. Don't let your own sense of unworthiness stop you. You are unworthy, but don't let that stop you. Don't be deflected by what others might say or think to put you off from this Jesus. Jesus says to all, without exception, come to me. And he means it. And you need him and the life which only he can give. Then verse 32, Jesus asks these blind men. And stopping, Jesus called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Lord, let our eyes be opened." And Jesus, in pity, touched their eyes, and immediately they received their sight. Well, in that cry for mercy, these blind men had shown that their spiritual eyesight was already sharp, because they'd seen this was God's king, that what they needed for him was mercy. And notice when they then come to him and cry out, verse 34 tells us that Jesus acted in pity, or as we might want to put it, with deep compassion. Jesus cares for those who cry out to him. And I hope we realize we are the beggars at the side of the road. We need what this king can give. We've got nothing to offer him. But look at that, Jesus is full of compassion. We can be so sure because we know he kept on that road to Jerusalem to die as a ransom for many, for us. So then we see Jesus gladly, immediately, of course, gives them back their sight. And that is a picture that their physical sight now reflects that spiritual sight which they had. For finally, for those who do see clearly, for those who all this has come together, they see Jesus, and so they ask for mercy. Well, what comes next? What marks those with good eyesight? Well, what did these formerly blind men do? Did they go off and do their own thing? Did they plan how, now that they could see, well, this is going to help them in so many areas of life to get ahead? Hardly. Look at those words at the end of verse 34. They followed him. That is, they followed in the way of the crucified Savior. Let's pray as we close. Our Father, we do so praise you for the truly great one, your Son, our Lord Jesus. Thank you that he came to serve us at such cost, giving his life as a ransom for many. And we do thank you for opening our eyes to see Jesus clearly, and so to realize our need for mercy. And so would we now be those who do follow faithfully along the way, giving of ourselves in service of others.